Our guest today has built, from scratch, an iconic UK fragrance house, one which is synonymous with both luxury and quality. They're one of those brands that if you know, then you know. They focus on building amazing fragrances with unusual twists, precious ingredients, and unexpected surprises. So please join me in welcoming to the podcast Linda Pilkington, the founder of Ormond Jame. Hi, Linda. How are you doing?
Hello, Nicola. How are you doing? I'm very well, thanks.
So, Linda, I know that the story of how Ormond Jame came about is quite an interesting one. Do you want to give our listeners a bit of an overview as to how that came to be, please?
Sure. So, I'm actually from Cheshire, a very, very small village in the middle of nowhere called Bowden. That's two pubs and a church. There was nothing. I mean, going to Manchester was a big day out, something you did twice a year. So we had to occupy ourselves at the weekend, especially if it was raining. There was no cinema or, you know, we didn't have digital phones or TikTok or anything like that. We used to get, for our birthdays, big craft boxes of, you know, Vogue beauty books, how to make your own, you know, hair conditioner, face masks. I used to get a lot of how to make scented candles, boxes, that type of thing. So come rainy Saturday, Sunday afternoons, out came all the craft work boxes. So I enjoyed it a lot. And I was quite a dab hand. But I was also, there's a bit of me that was quite entrepreneurial and I always wanted to up my pocket money. And I used to just think, now I've got these 16 candles. What on earth am I going to do with these? I will sell them. So I'd go around knocking on people's door. But eventually our vicar from Bowden Church said, I'll give you a table outside the church twice a year at Easter and Christmas. You give me 50% of your profits for the church collection. So, I mean, it's every little girl's dream, isn't it, to have a little shop. You know, little table is like, you know, it's the ultimate. So I used to make things throughout the year from my craft boxes ready for these events. And then obviously I could go off and buy something nice for my bedroom and then he could get his donation. So it kind of started off there. And then roll the clock forward many decades, well, not that many decades, but quite a while. And I bumped into a gentleman that was working at Chanel Fine Jewelry in Old Bond Street. I was working two roads back for a Japanese agrochemical company. And I just bumped into him. He remembered me and he said, oh, you know, I'm just opening the Chanel Fine Jewelry shop. It would be wonderful if you could make me a candle. It would mean more to me than going off to buy it. And it's really in keeping with that whole, you know, atelier vibe that you get from Chanel with all them sewing on their buttons and things like that. So I was absolutely thrilled. I realized he probably thinks I'm a lot better than I really am. But I just thought, all right, I'm going to really step up here and make something of it. Went off to Grasse. I spent about £800 of my own money getting the mold fitted. There was a brief. It had to be the color of these Chinese screens in the Paris Ritz. Ultimately, bravo, I managed to satisfy them. They said, we'll have 50. I was thinking, oh, crikey, I've only got two molds. That's going to take a while. So because it takes 2 days to make one candle, actually. So, but anyway, it was fine. They said to me, you have to write an invoice. Which I did, and they said, no, you need to have a company, which I didn't have. So I registered a company name. I asked my husband what we should call it. I didn't want to call it Linda Pilkington. So he said, well, you're Linda Jane, and you live and you've made our kitchen into a studio. So you could be either Jane Ormond or Ormond Jane. I was like, that'll do. That's fine. So we registered that, which is quite straightforward in the UK. And then my first invoice was then obviously to Chanel Fine Jewelry. I was really hoping to make a living out of this. Now, I did work full time, but I went on to do a trade show in Top Draw at the weekends. I got lots of customers. I got the attention of Burberry, and they wanted two candles for their designer at the time, who was called Chris. And we made two more candles. And then, of course, word of mouth. And as time went on, I just thought I could actually probably give up my job and do this full time. But I'd have to be very, very careful. And I didn't want to actually get investors in. But I just wanted, like, whatever came in, I would use that money to expand and to make things better and to get more stock and to get more oils. So that's why, you know, I've had the company for 23 years. And it's still privately owned. Of course, today it's a much bigger outfit. We've got a certain style of perfumery that just came about through conversation of using ingredients not widely used in the perfume industry, traveling around the world looking for these ingredients. You know, obviously we're the first ones to use hemlock as our signature scent. So we had a good angle. And then ultimately, you know, that's where we are today, 23 years later. And we've got about 47 members of staff. We've moved out to a huge studio in Kent where everything's still handmade, hand-poured. Well, actually, it's not hand-poured. It's semi-automatic. So you put the bottles in, it pours four bottles and you move on. I think it's controlled by a pedal. And then we've got staff all over the world. And I think we now have something like 448 boutiques and points of sales around the world. And we're still growing and I'm still enjoying it. I'm still healthy and fighting fit. So it's all good.
Yeah, it's an amazing meteoric rise as well over a sustained period of effort. And we'll come back to that. We'll circle back to it. But one of the things I was really intrigued about was the bit in your bio where you discuss how you settled in South America for a while and started selling ice cream.
Yeah.
What led you there? And did that experience help you at all when you decided to create the fragrance brand?
Well, so at the time I had a different boyfriend, not the man I married. And he was quite an adventurous person. And we had gone to Rio de Janeiro for the carnival. And we were loving it. It was just such fun. And then he just said, why don't we stay here or like travel around South America and see what we can do? So, you know, when you're young, free and, you know, full of energy and, you know, you've got no obligations, no children, it's like, yeah, why not? Let's stay here. So it's like, you know, staying here, mom, like it's everything in South America. So we traveled around, went to Argentina, we went to Paraguay, Uruguay, and then we settled on this area called Cacupé, which was kind of like on the border of Paraguay going towards Argentina. And we rented a ranch from these people. It was $2,000 a month. It was milking cows, and that was it, milked by hand. And the families live actually on the land with you. So we set that up and we changed it from hand milk to automations. And what was very interesting is like, have you ever heard of a Mennonite? So the Mennonites are people like live in a community, usually German. They've kind of fled the Second World War. They've settled down in South America, and they kind of live like an Amish, a Hamish style of living. It's a form of Christianity. All the ladies wear a black dress with a bonnet. The men wear dungarees. They're usually dairy farmers. And they usually have the local co-op in town where you do your shopping if you're right out in the sticks. And so we sold our milk to the Mennonites. They used to come in, we just literally take it to the top of the road and off they went to go and get it. And then we went into soya, which was very, very easy to plant. And it was just all about irrigation. So that got on its feet very, very quickly. So I was very bored very fast because I'm not doing this manual work myself. So day in and day out, and I'm not somebody who can really keep still. And I kind of said to my mom on the phone, you know, I need to do something here. I can't just sit around a ranch all day long and ride a horse. And my mom said to me, well, it must be hot out there. Everybody likes ice cream when it's hot. And you love, you know, cooking and preparing things. And you've always had a fascination with that sort of thing. So I was like, yes, this is what I'm going to do. And when I get an idea in my head, I have to do it straight away. It's like jump in the car, go into town, go to the local ice cream parlor, look at the Mr. Whippy at the side. Where did they buy that machine from? That went to the one in Buenos Aires that had the Italian name of the gelato on the side of the fridge. Not the gelato, the type of fridge. You know, and I'm writing this all down, contacting them. Realizing then actually making ice cream is not that straightforward, and actually formulas for ice cream cost an absolute fortune. I'm going back quite a long time. A chocolate ice cream formula at that time was $10,000 to buy. I was like, what? So I met up with a guy who was an ex-ice cream maker for Mövenpick, which is a Swiss ice cream, and he happened to live in South America. And I hired him. I said, can you teach me how to make ice cream. And, you know, I mean, this guy was very eccentric. He was very particular. I had an ice cream maker in my hallway. So I'm forever, you know, converting parts of my house to some sort of studio. So I had a Mr. Whippy machine. I had a gelato machine. And he was explaining to me about the taste, the aftertaste after you've eaten an ice cream, why they serve a glass of water in Italy. And he was very strict, you know, about, you know, how much fresh lemon I could put into something. I wanted to have sorbets. Ultimately, I had said to him, how about we kind of like, instead of doing strawberry, vanilla, chocolate, let's do something a little bit like, let's add some cardamom. Let's like look for some local ingredients, local herbs and spices from Paraguay, Argentina. So it's a bit different, something that's really 21st century. So he was all for that. And he was working with me. And we opened up an ice cream parlor called Zigolo 21, 21st century ice cream. And I realized very quickly, it went very well. I had to actually increase the grid, the electricity grid, because I needed a walk-in fridge. And this particular shop that I had taken on didn't have enough electricity to do this. So I had to get extra electricity put in, all the things you learn as you go along. And then ultimately, I realized that people don't eat ice cream in the morning because it's something you do kind of like in the afternoon after you've had your siesta, you go out for an ice cream. So I quickly had to make the morning into things like croissants and sandwiches and things you can have for breakfast with coffee and tea and nice little biscuits. In the afternoon, everybody started coming for ice cream. And then I wanted to stay open in the evening. I got an alcohol license and made part of the ice cream bar into a bar. And then I was serving ice cream on like a beautiful, like sort of beautiful dish plate. And I was like serving ice cream for two. So you could go out for the evening with your boyfriend or girlfriend or whoever, and with just girlfriends, and sit there and you shared this beautiful plateau with, you know, strawberries and fruit and all sorts of very fancy stuff. So actually, it actually became very successful because we were literally open nearly 24 hours. I mean, we used to, I think I used to get home about 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was open again. It was open again at like 7 a.m. for coffee and breakfast. So it was quite hard work, but it paid off. Off the back of that, I got concessions in supermarkets. They asked me to open up like a small booth with my ice creams and Mr. Whippy just by the checkout counter. So I also had about 10 supermarkets which we were delivering to. So it was very successful, actually. It was hard work. I was literally like sleeping about 5 or 6 hours a day. And I just thought, what have I got myself into? It's like, but then unfortunately, my mother became rather ill and I was the only one that wasn't married. And my other sisters, you know, had children and everything. So I said, like, you know, I'll go home and look after mum. And I left the ice cream parlor with the sole intention that I'd go back at some point. But like my mother passed away about 3 months later. And during that 3 months, the whole business kind of went, dun, 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 you know, and people were phoning me up saying, you know, your lights have gone out outside. Nobody's changed the bulb. Bum, 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 bum. Then somebody sent me a message saying, I've just had your something, something ice cream. It tasted ghastly. So obviously they're not making it the way they're meant to make it, or they haven't, because you can only keep fresh cream to make ice cream for 2 days. And after 2 days, any ice cream left over, I used to chuck out. I think they were just serving it, and whether it had gone a bit sour or not. So ultimately, I got a lawyer and I just said to them, can you just go and close it down? Because I'm going to just stay in England now. So I stayed, you know, I didn't go back. And then once I'd got back to the UK, I just thought, I'm going to stay now. I've had my fun and games and, you know, I've had plenty of, you know, traveled around, seen lots of things. So it's time to get serious and, you know, make some roots back into the UK.
What a fascinating journey that's led you to where you are now. It's so interesting. Have you ever been tempted to make a fragrance that references that time or has an ice cream element in it?
Well, so I've always been interested in, I mean, fragrance and flavours come together. When you go to Grasse, when you go to France, most of the companies out there, all the big companies, Femenich, IFF, Expressions de Parfumée, they all say underneath fragrance and flavors, because actually they make a lot of money from creating flavors, you know, to flavor crisps or the smell of freshly baked bread to pump out into something like that. So I've always had a passion for cooking. I did launch something called Gourmandjane. It's like Gourmandjane. And what I was doing was, I wasn't just necessarily ice creams. I was making dishes and puddings using edible oils, perfume oils. I used to film it, actually, and call it Gourmandjane and put it on YouTube. And I loved it. I tended to do puddings more than anything with the perfumes as opposed to ice cream. So maybe it's a good idea to do a nice little sorbet with something, maybe with the, be quite nice to do with Levant, you know, with a nice little peony taste would be quite lovely, something elegant. I know that a Japanese lady chef sent me a recipe to make a pudding with the cherry blossom for our Sakura perfume. So I haven't quite got round to doing that yet, but it's something on the hit list. So I enjoy making something that goes with the perfumes, whether it doesn't matter if it's a main dish. When I went to France, I had this lovely, lovely cake in Saint-Tropez called Trapezien, Saint-Tropezien, which is their local, what they're famous for. And so in that instance, then I'm kind of like tasting it all, getting the recipe and then changing it. So when you do the creme for the middle, I was putting in, obviously they make like whip it up with sugar. I was putting in bergamot oils and things from the south of France. And I was making a very delicate, very light cream that had a slightly more top-noted bergamot, lemon, orange flavor to the cream to add into my Saint-Tropezien cake, which is beyond delicious. But I mustn't eat too much of that.
sounds gorgeous.
Oh, it's delicious. It really is delicious.
And talking of gorgeous, you've got a new fragrance just coming out literally as we speak, this absolutely stunning arabesque.
Yes.
Can we talk a little bit about what made you want to create that scent?
Well, so arabesque is going to go into the Four Corners of the Earth collection. So we have three collections of perfumes. We've got the original one, which is the signature perfume, and that's all about using ingredients not widely used in the perfume industry, like tolu, osmanthus from all parts of the world. Then we had the Four Corners of the Earth, where arabesque is going to go into, and that is talking about different regions of the world, but not necessarily about that country. It's more about London. It's about the Four Corners of the Earth being in our country, in the UK, where everybody's welcome. You know, we have all these different walks of life from all over the world. You walk around London, you've got, you've got in Acton, you've got lots of Japanese people. Go to Belgrave, lots of Russians. If you know, Knightsbridge is full of Middle Eastern people. So my take on that was the Four Corners of the Earth is in our hometown, which, you know, we get a lot of inspiration from all the creativity they bring to us from their country. So arabesque is a nod towards the Middle East. Obviously, arabesque is also a piece of Islamic art, which is like, it's usually like dried twigs, dried wood, entwined with flowers and fruits. And of course, arabesque is a ballet movement, a very elegant ballet movement. So I just wanted to bring something for that region, because we have Japan, and we have, you know, Russia, India. So I think I was just I think I was in some museum that I saw this piece of Islamic art, and they said this is the arabesque style, which is that lovely intricate pattern. And you know, as soon as I hear something that I quite like the idea of, out comes the notebook, you know, arabesque Islamic art. I'm very my husband and I like go around, you know, as we, you know, life goes on each day. If we see something on the TV or in a shop window with a name that we like, we always write it in our book. We've got a big book of words and names that we like. So arabesque was actually in my notebook before the perfume. So it was probably there for about a year and a half, 2 years. And then, of course, when I wanted to make that, I was just going through my notebook thinking, so Arabesque had the name before the perfume, because I thought, that's a great name. I love it. Islamic art, all this lovely entwined. So we set off from that. And it was a collaboration, actually, with Expressions de Parfumée in Grasse. So, you know, we work with them. And there's a lady there called Celine. And I sent through the ingredients, what have to be in it, and everything, the whole idea behind it and what it means to me, what where it's going to go into the four corners of the earth. I go out there quite a lot because they worked with me on the four corners of the earth. So, and it came, you know, in I know, it was, you know, we go backwards and forwards a few times still. I think, yes, you've got it, because we do have a palette that we work with, and that palette is quite particular to our house. Because we don't make heavy perfumes. So even if one of our, you know, if our perfume says patchouli, pepper, pimento, oud, da-da, it's never going to be a heavy perfume, because we construct it with certain other accords that make the perfume open up and breathe. So you can smell the ingredients coming out. So Arabesque, even though, like, you've got black pepper, you've got saffron, you've got moss, patchouli, a little tiny bit of oud, you've got musk. So, you know, you think, wow. And then you've got a jasmine absolute, rose absolute. But when you wear it, it opens up and you can smell all the ingredients coming out. So it's very elegant.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way of putting it. It definitely has room to breathe.
Yes.
It doesn't overpower you, does it, at all? It's
well, I don't like perfumes that are overpowering. I find them very, I hate it when like a perfume is so strong that you can't smell anything. It's just like a big powerhouse. And, you know, it's like hitting a brick wall, or when the perfume enters the room before you do. You get a lot of perfumes on the market now that have that very, very strong accord. And then you can't sort out the woods for the trees with it, actually. It's just like a big cauldron of something that without any breathing. I it's not my style. You smell it quite a lot when you go walk past people. It's kind of like quite a big trend now. People like it. It's not really my style. I do recognize that it's what people want and they do like it, but I can't bring myself to construct anything along those lines.
When you're thinking of adding a new fragrance to the brand, how does that work between you and the perfumer? You've kind of touched on it a little bit already, but I wondered if we could dive into it a bit more.
Sure.
How much free rein do you give them? And do you always have a clear idea from the start as to what that finished fragrance is going to smell like?
Yeah, so things have changed a lot, Nicola, since I started. 23 years ago, I could actually literally sit in my kitchen and pour different oils and smell them and decide, yes, maybe I'd like a few more floral notes and that, go back and visit it, put some alcohol in it, spray it, see if it's developing nicely. And then if I think this is really pretty, I would put it into bottles, crimp it, and take it to my boutique in Mayfair. Well, of course, this is all not allowed anymore. And we've got lots of rules and regulations and compliance, and it's getting more and more complicated by the day. What tends to happen now, and it's not unique to me, it's, you know, quite normal, is that, let's say, for example, I am looking at 2024, and I'm thinking, I tend to think also, what are people asking for when they come into the boutique? Some, you know, when people say, do you have anything with patchouli, or do you have, I always ask the staff also, what are people asking for? Because you kind of need to fill in the gaps, what's in your repertoire. You know, so I've got lots of lovely florals. I've got osmanthus, frangipani, taif, lots of, you know, but maybe I haven't got enough like patchoulis or sandalwoods. So I first of all look at feedback from what the staff are telling me. And then I look at the year ahead, you know, what it holds. And then I start thinking about what perfume would really sit nicely in the library of what we have, that should be a great addition. And then I start working on that idea, which direction it's going to go into. then I start looking through my little book of names and see if anything jumps out at me that excites me. And I think, oh, that could be very interesting. I remember where I was in which country when I saw that name, and I conjure up a vision. And then I actually kind of know how I want it to smell, because I really am going by what's missing from everything. So that's when I start constructing it. Now, a lot of perfumers can construct the perfume, but you have to understand that these are all poured in the big houses around Europe, and it's done in a very extraordinary way. So, for example, at Expressions de Parfumée, it's like a railway track that goes around a big room. And let's say, for example, we've got to the point of the formula's decided and it's been approved, that goes into a computer. And then an empty drum sits on like a railway track and goes up and down different tracks, stopping underneath different cauldrons, under different drums. And the computer is computerized, so it just pours out exactly that part of the formula, and then it stops, and then it moves on. It goes, so it's very, very interesting. Now, but ultimately, when it's finished and it comes off, it gets a dipstick in it. And if you get a green light, it means this is exactly how it's meant to smell, like nothing's gone wrong. So it's technically perfect and it's technically correct. The stage before that, they've got to do all your IFRA and compliance safety data sheets. So they might say, the problem is you have got X percentage of this and this. And when you put this through the machine, you know, it reads out all the highs and lows like a computer, a bit like, you know, when you're in hospital and you're having your heart checked and it all goes up and down. So that comes out, and they might say, you've got too much of a floral note with this, your ISO E-Super sends it over the edge on certain allergens. So the only way you can make this compliant is we have to lower this ingredient, but they have the expertise to know what to do about it. I don't, and most perfumers don't know what to do about it. It's more of a software, you know, that says, okay, if you're not compliant because of that allergen and that allergen, if we lower that down, we can increase that and add that. It will smell exactly the same, but it will be compliant. It's very, very technical. It's not something you can do at home. And that's just how it is today. It's the same for everybody. So you have to be very much on top of what's acceptable and what's not. You do get plenty of warning. I mean, we had a great big sort out that was compliancy. It was midnight, 28th of February this year, 2023. All certain ingredients of a certain had to be withdrawn. They gave us 2 years' notice to do this. So you just know going forward, if you're going to make a perfume, you're not going to include these allergens because there's no point. So you have to stay on top of what's compliant, what's not, so that, you know, you stay ahead of the times. And then if they say to you also, they could say, we know that in 2 or 3 years' time, that will be unacceptable. So let's counteract that now. They have got the technology, the software, and everything to make it perfect, which I can't do. So it's and that's how everybody works today. So I, you know, the people, they know me very well now. I mean, we've been together for about 23 years. So the two ladies from Grasse actually just came to London last week and went to my laboratory studio. So they spent 2 days with me. We were just smelling new ingredients that were on the market, new oils that they had, which was very nice, you know, for me then to say, okay, I've got this, what can I do with them? It can be quite exciting. I might not do anything with them for 2, 3, 4 years, who knows? But during lockdown, or just before lockdown, maybe, I got sent an oil from IFF, and it was an oak moss. And oak moss had kind of been withdrawn for quite a while. And it's a real classic scent, perhaps a little bit dated, but obviously we could modernize it. But it was sitting there, you know, sitting there staring at me for quite a while. And I thought, I must do something with the oak moss. And what they had done is they had found a way to clean it. Their new cleaning system of the oak moss took out the two offending allergens which had banned it. So It was very nice that there was this new oak moss on the market that we could now use it again. And, you know, I think I need to bring it into this century, as opposed to a perfume that smells like from the 70s, which used a lot of oak moss in those days. So with their help and their ingenuity and their computers and their compliance, we were able to make a fabulous oak moss, which I called Avernia, which was Latin for oak moss perfume, that is actually quite tenacious, because oak moss is quite tenacious, but it's not rude. You know, it's not like a heavy, and we did lots of little tiny drops of floral notes just to open it more up. And it was hugely, hugely successful. But that took quite a long time, actually, of going backwards and forwards to get it into smelling something that didn't smell old-fashioned, you know, to give it a bit of a cutting edge of creativity, as opposed to, you know, the classic, you know, French perfumes from the 70s and 80s. So that's how it works these days. It's just like that. There's nothing you could do, but it still all works. It's still very nice. There is a good reason for all of it as well. It's not like it's like just a pain in the neck for no particular good reason. There is a valid reason behind it all.
Yeah, of course. And I wonder, are there any materials that are sat on your desk at the moment looking at you and begging to be included in an upcoming release?
Gosh, there's loads. But let me just... I was looking at a new, haven't actually got the oil. I'm looking at a new vanilla, a Madagascan vanilla, which is particularly beautiful, and it's really soft, and it's I'm thinking that will definitely be used for sure. Hugely expensive, but you know, I don't really care about things like that. It's it'll be worth it for sure, definitely.
I'm a huge fan of vanilla fragrances, so good vanilla.
Okay. Oh, well, definitely good to know. Well, we used to have a lovely perfume called Vanille d'Iris, and it was, again, this lovely, it was a beautiful perfume, but we had to, so we never say things are discontinued, but we say things go into hibernation. When they had this massive IFRA clear out, we wanted to be compliant by February the 28th, and so we had to withdraw one or two, and then... They're such good perfumes. You don't want to just say discontinued. So they're sitting there waiting to be relaunched, but compliant. And if I can't hit it on the head so it's perfect, because I really don't want, let's say Oris Noir had a lot of fans. If I bring it back to market and it's not 100% Oris Noir, I know I'll be inundated with complaints. So if I can't make it exactly how it's meant to be, I will just change the formula a bit and give it a new name, because these are very good perfumes and they perform beautifully and they're very elegant. So it's a shame just to say, okay, bye-bye. So there are some perfumes like Vanille d'Iris, Oris Noir, Zazane. I've got a knockout vetiver perfume which had to be taken off. Really, really difficult to reconstruct it, because according to IFRA rules and regulations, I could only pour it at 2%, which meant it'd be 98% alcohol, 2% of my original formula. That's how off the Richter scale it was, with all these huge amounts of natural ingredients. So they were like, no, 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 no. So I will bring that back, but it's not going to come back until it's absolutely perfect. At the moment, it's a bit thin, and it's got to have that, you know, like this real sort of an effervescent burst when you first spray it. And so we're still working on that. That's just how it is. So there's quite a few that will come back over the next 3 to 4 years once they're perfect. If they're not perfect, they will be given a new name and they'll be slightly different, but just as good.
Mm. I think there'll be a lot of people very excited to hear your plans for some of those. What do you think makes a good perfume in today's market? And does that change at all, or is it pretty consistent? You know, is a good perfume always a good perfume, was a good perfume 23 years ago? Is that not a good perfume now? How has that altered?
It has definitely altered, because, you know, people's taste and style of life changes, as in all walks of life, you know, with so many aspects. Of course, you've got your die-hard perfumes that people will always love to wear. Mitsuku, Chanel No. 5, all those perfumes are great. People will always love them forever. But there is, if you're particularly interested in perfume and you know that's your thing. There is a new style that in about a decade, maybe 15 years ago, it was all very much like oud fragrances, a lot of oud. All the houses started having it became a confirmed category in the perfume industry. Now I've noticed recently that people actually are more gravitating towards perfumes that open up more, which is actually more my genre, my style of perfumery. There was one or two perfume launches that were hugely successful, where it didn't actually even have a top note, but it was like linear. But I think these type of like people go crazy for certain perfumes, like Baccarat Rouge. And then there comes a point where other things come along and they go, oh, right. But there's millions of people in the world that have never heard or smelt of Baccarat Rouge. So it's still got its legs for a long time. And it will, you know, but the diehard perfumers, you know, they've been there, done that, worn it loads of times. And now they're on to the next thing because that's what they love. That's their passionate about perfume. So I know that a friend of mine was just in Paris. And she said to me, I went to the new store, the Louis Vuitton store. It's amazing. You have to go. I said, no, I'm definitely going to go there. She goes, I discovered a perfume and the assistant said it's new. And I said, what is it? What was it? She goes, it's called Baccarat Rouge. And I didn't know if that had the heart to tell her it's not new, but yeah, there are people that are in the know and know exactly what's being launched and what it smells like. And these are all the perfumists, the perfume bloggers, the people that absolutely live, breathe, eat, smell perfume every day of their life, like probably you and I. And then you've got people who perfume is an essential part of their everyday life, but you know, they've got other passions. So, you know, the good thing about it is, yes, styles change, trends change, but there's still millions and millions of people that, you know, are still loving this and loving that. And they've just discovered this, even though it's been on the market for 15 years. So it's not such a bad thing. But I've noticed that most of the perfumes that are already getting a lot of attention now are quite, have a lot of air and not so heavy. And people are focusing on how does that perfume make you feel, as opposed to this smells nice. It's like when I wear this perfume, I feel. So I had always said, I tend to gravitate towards Ormond Woman, which is our signature scent. And because it's got the hemlock in it, and for the best part of 17 years, it was the only perfume in the world that had hemlock in it. I used to spray it because it made me feel that I had some invisible power and protected me from dark forces. So if I had any difficulties in my career, because, you know, it's not always a bed of roses in life, you know, if I had problems, I used to really think if I wear my Ormond Woman, it'd be like a shield that protects me and nobody can touch what I want to do. I will go forth and be triumphant anyway, no matter what you say or what or whoever's giving me the grief. So there was a point about maybe 4 years ago that I wore Ormond Woman every single day and night, and I just didn't stop spraying it on myself for the best part of a year. Until a certain situation had resolved itself and gone. And so I think there is that element of how does a perfume make you feel? That's a new aspect as well. And I think it's quite interesting. I think there's a couple of perfume houses that do focus on that and say that they've done testing with neurotransmitters to see how does it change the brain if you've got certain ingredients? Of course, it's very subtle. You know, you don't suddenly become a different person overnight, but it's an interesting aspect and perhaps the new language of perfume.
Mm, yeah. One of the things that I find really interesting about you, Linda, is we've met several times now, and yeah, you have such energy and such passion about you for fragrance. I wonder what keeps this industry interesting for you? Is it goals for your brand? Is it developing new things? You know, what keeps you so passionate and so engaged about it?
I think I'm ambitious. So even though people wouldn't actually think I am because, you know, my company is still mine. It's independent. I don't have investors. So it's not about some massive financial gain. It's more about I really enjoy building up something that's tangible, something I can see. I get a lot of satisfaction from watching something grow. I've got some breaking news for you, Nicola. You can be the first to know, but I haven't signed the contract yet. But I am looking at a bigger store, and it's only a few doors down from here. So I'm not moving arcades. I'm just moving into something bigger. Haven't actually signed it yet, but my lawyer and their lawyer are talking, and it's the draft contract. So a lot of people are saying to me, are you crazy? Why are you taking on all this extra cost? You've got, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful premises, and it's definitely a step up. Why on earth, you know, people know where I am. People come through the door automatically. We get busy. And commercially, we are successful. You know, I'm sitting upstairs now. There's no doors in this office, by the way. So anybody who comes through the door, I can hear everybody chatting, and they can hear me chatting to you. So I think people are saying to me, why would you do that? It's like, it's a lot of work. You've got to, you know, do the whole shop fit. You've got to get everything done. You've got to put in air conditioning, da, 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 da. Why? When people are coming into your boutique anyway. And it's because I suppose there's a bit of me that likes a challenge. I'm quite ambitious. I love a checklist. So I think that's what makes me tick, you know. And I just think, okay, I've got this project. I've got this project. I'm traveling. I'm doing a big tour across Taiwan, Philippines, China, South Korea, at the same time as opening a new store, at the same time of this, at the same time of that. And I also want to try and make, I want to have like a perfumer's garden in my garden. So I want to change all the garden. So all the flowers I'm growing throughout the year have some reference to my perfumes. And so that when I wake up in the morning, go and sit outside and have a cup of tea, I'm just looking at the flowers that I like to work with. So I'm doing that as well. Now, somebody might say, you know, but you can do more than one thing at a time, because as soon as you say, I need some air conditioning, it's not going to happen straight away. So then I can also say, what plants can I grow in January, February, March that will be very, very scented? At the same time, the next phone call could be, what are we going to do in South Korea to make it wow? You know, what are we going to build? So you can do lots of things side by side. I do have a full day, admittedly, but when it gets to about 8:45 at night, I like to just call it a day, and I make a big flask of herbal tea, and I kind of lie on my bed with my herbal tea and my husband, and I like to watch TV.
Well, thank you for sharing that amazing news with us, and I'm sure everybody, including myself, wish you all the best with the opening of the new shop. And
yes,
it sounds fabulous. It sounds really, really exciting.
It really is. It really is. I can't wait.
So that's the end of my sensible, serious questions. And now I want to bombard you with some quick fire ones, if that's all right. So what's your favourite smell?
Orange blossom.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's a good one. I think
I mean, when I see an orange blossom bush, I stick my nose in it and I can't leave. And sometimes I just pick those and I just put them as I'm walking around, like underneath my nose.
Yeah, I can understand why completely. What smells do you dislike?
I don't like the smell of petrol. Hence, I've had an electric car for 18 years, so that I don't have to go to a petrol station anymore. Because petrol stations literally make me gag. I can't cope with the smell of petrol.
Yeah, that's fair enough. If you could go anywhere and smell anything from any point in history, where would you go and what would you smell?
Ooh, I would probably go to 17th century grass at the time when, because grass used to be all about leather and tanneries before it became known for its flowers. They actually started growing the flowers and everything to mask the smell of this revolting tanneries. But I would like to smell those tanneries, that leather, that raw leather. I think that would be very, very interesting. And my second choice would be probably, I wouldn't mind going to Cuba, where they're hanging up all the tobacco leaves and shoots, you know, before they're rolled into cigars. I think that would be a beautiful, beautiful smell. Possibly at the time when it was all still handmade, you know, so I don't know when that was, but whenever they made handmade cigars you know, rolled on the thigh of a virgin or whatever.
Yeah, that sounds great. What do you think fear smells like?
I think fear smells like putrid matter. I think it smells rotten.
What smell transports you to a strong olfactive memory, and where does it take you?
Well, here's the thing. Probably the smell of a pub. When I was quite young, because our village was very small, and like I said, it was two pubs and a church. It wasn't unusual to come out of the church, go across the road to the pub, and the children kind of sat in the garden with a shandy or a dandelion and burdock. But if you walked through the pub to go to the bathroom, the pub always had a particular smell. I didn't mind it, actually, but it was like a combination of beer and cigarettes. These weren't like sort of horrible pubs, like, you know, that are, you know, these were quite like countryside pubs, but it definitely had a particular smell that I picked up on and kind of like locked it in my brain, actually, of like, that's how the pub smells.
Yeah. I love the smell of pubs.
Yeah. And, well, you can get some pretty awful ones. Yeah. We had two pubs. One was called the Stamford Arms and one was the Griffin. They were next to each other. The Stamford Arms was mainly where the young people hung out, but I was too young to go to a pub, so I had to be with my parents. And then there was the Griffin. The Griffin was for the posh people, and it had a very nice garden with lots of flowers, and inside was like stables, horse stables, and you sat in like your own little stable. It was very nice, but it had a particular smell about it.
Yeah. I can imagine it. What fragrance are you wearing right now?
Ormond Woman, because whenever I'm going to have an interview or like something like that, I put the Ormond Woman on to like give me that special power and protect me.
Oh, you definitely don't need protecting from us.
No, I know, but it's kind of like I've kind of got my everything set in stone at the moment. Like, you know, this is what Christmas Day, it's Orris Noir. And when I go on holiday, I take frangipani and osmanthus and champaca. When it's autumn, I start wearing tolu. I'm kind of like a creature of habits.
No, everybody has their little rituals, don't they?
Yeah, for sure.
What does summer smell of to you?
Probably sun lotion, ambre soleil, that type of, that lovely sort of, you know, when as soon as you're protecting your skin, you've got that lovely bergamot. Ambre soleil has a lot, you know, a bit of a bergamot in it, and I really enjoy this. I love the smell of sun cream.
Me too.
The old-fashioned sun creams, like the, you know, the oils that you used to put on. Pisbuin, ambre soleil, that, you know, I used to love all that.
Mm. What's your favourite food smell?
Basmati rice. I make it, my husband taught me how to make this, actually. So we obviously wash the rice and give it a good rinse, but then we get a big pot of put butter into it. So we put a big knob of butter and then we toss the rice into that and let the butter coat all the rice. It smells divine. I can't tell you. It's just, you can't wait to start eating the rice. And then once it's all covered in butter, you put in your water. You let it keep it bubbling until it gets little holes. And then you put it to simmer and then put the lid on. And then sometimes just before the end, I might throw in a cardamom pod. But you get this lovely buttery, I think I love buttery rice. It's so much nicer than just a plain steamed rice. It's far more yummy and it smells divine. And for me, it smells of home. So home you associate with comfort, security, you know, everything, you know, family. So if I put my key in the door and I can smell basmati rice, or if I can smell basmati rice cooking somewhere, I think that's my favorite smell.
Mm. That's wonderful.
Now I want to eat some rice for lunch.
What smell reminds you of school?
Ooh, the canteen. It was awful. Probably cabbage. And beetroot. We used to have boiled beetroot, like the whole beetroot was boiled and put on your plate. And they used to boil cabbage and then just literally scoop out of the water, boiled cabbage and boiled beetroot. I mean, seriously, you had all these methods of how to get rid of your school lunch because we were obliged to eat it all. And if we didn't eat it all, we weren't allowed to leave the table. And we had a very, very strict lady called Miss Almond. And, you know, she would like stand at the top of the table with her arms crossed and you had to eat every last morsel. So like literally everybody had a little plastic bag inside their skirt that they could like just put their lunch and then they all had to run to the gardens or the bathroom to tip out. Such is life. Yeah, I remember once I had to stay behind because we had this rock hard piece of liver, which was like as dry as like the sole of your shoe, and this beetroot that, and I just couldn't eat it. And I was like chewing this piece of like leather for ages. And I was with another girl that couldn't eat hers either, called Christina. And Miss Allman was there with her arms folded. And I said, oh my God. And then Christina said to me, what are we going to do? I said, I don't know, because we can't, she's watching us. We can't get rid of it. And then she said, should we commit suicide? I said, no, it's not that drastic. So I said, no, that's totally unnecessary.
And finally, if scientists were able to invent a smellophone, who would you ring first?
A smellophone?
Yeah.
Who would I ring first? God, there's so many people I would like to. I think I probably would like to phone Elizabeth I, if she'd take my call. I'd love to talk to somebody like that. I mean, she's just like this woman, this powerful woman surrounded by men. And you just think, I'd like to know your style. You know, okay, you are the queen, but at the same time, I'd like to hear you speak, and I'd like to maybe, pick up a tip or two.
And if people want to know more about your brand, what's your web address and social media handles?
Well, you could log on to ormondjane.com, and then if you scroll to the very bottom, all our social network handle addresses are there.
Brilliant. Linda, it's been an absolute pleasure as always to talk to you. And
thank you, Nicola.
Sit and natter for days.
For sure. I would like, have a cup of tea and some biscuits. Take care of yourself. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Sniff Perfume podcast is written and produced by me, Nicola Thomas, with music by Phil Collingwood. You can find all our reviews online at the-sniff.com. We're also on Instagram at the Sniff website or Twitter with the same handle. If you'd like to support our work, please find me on Buy Me A Coffee. The web address is buymeacoffee.com/thesniff.
That's brilliant.
Our guest today was Linda Pilkington from UK brand Ormond Jane. We weren't paid in cash or in kind to feature this brand. We have received samples and full bottles from the brand in the past so we could try the scents out. Thanks very much for listening.